It took more than a century for the Star-Spangled Banner to become our national anthem. Francis Scott Key's lyrics, written 200 years ago this week, was set to a bawdy British drinking song, and it faced stiff competition from other patriotic tunes. But, like the defenders of Fort McHenry, it prevailed. This week, Baltimore celebrates the Star-Spangled Spectacular. In this hour of midday, the unlikely story of America's national anthem and its musical dynamics. We'll hear from a historian, a music scholar, and a young soprano who sang the Star-Spangled Banner at Camden Yard. First, the news. And welcome back to Midday, everyone. Our second hour, Dan Roderick's here. Thank you again for joining us, making Midday part of your day. Oh, say, can you see by the dawn's early light? Oh, say, can you see by the dawn's early light? Familiar words to any American, but did you know that it took more than 100 years for the Star-Spangled Banner to become America's national anthem? It took 117 years and an executive order and a law to cement the song's place as an American tradition. Francis Scott Key wrote the lyrics to the Star-Spangled Banner while aboard a British ship in Baltimore Harbor, September 1814. That's why all the fuss down at the Inner Harbor this weekend. It's the 200th anniversary of the Battle of Baltimore. Francis Scott Key was an attorney. He was there to negotiate the release of American hostages. But during this trip, the British attacked Fort McHenry, and there was Key out there. He was stuck aboard a British vessel until the bombing ended. He witnessed the British's failure and the survival of Fort McHenry and the flag there. And that's what, you know, inspired the song. He wrote the lyrics to the Star-Spangled Banner on the morning of September 14th, 1814, on the back of a letter as the flag waved proudly above Fort McHenry. Thus, the words that became the lyrics of the national anthem. So there's a long story there. We're going to get it today from Mark Ferris, a journalist and independent historian who is fascinated by the Star-Spangled Banner, so fascinated now that he's written a book about it called Star-Spangled Banner, The Unlikely Story of America's National Anthem. And it's available. It's published by Johns Hopkins University Press. So first, I want to greet Mark Ferris and welcome him to this show on the Star-Spangled Banner. Nice to have you with us, Mark.
Nice to be here. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, congratulations on the book, too.
Thank you.
And also joining us today, because we're going to talk about the performance, the musical dynamics of the national anthem. You know, it's not an easy song to sing, and the lyrics are famously forgotten and stumbled over by some very important singers in our time. So we're going to get to talk about that today, and we have two guests here to talk about that aspect of it, a music scholar and a soprano, Paul Matthews, the Associate Dean of Academic Affairs at the Peabody Conservatory of the Johns Hopkins University. He has taught as part of the music theory faculty there since 1998. And Paul, it's nice to have you back on the show.
Great to be back.
Yeah, I was trying to remember the last time you were here. We were talking about the music, the singing of Doris Day, right?
That's correct.
So here we'll be talking about the national anthem. I appreciate you. And you brought Victoria McGrath with you.
Hello.
Hello, Victoria. Victoria is a soprano graduate student at the Peabody, and you actually have sang the national anthem in a stadium, right? In our own stadium.
Yes, at Camden Yards this summer for the Orioles.
Oh, you know, I was just talking the other day with Dan Connolly, who is the actually I wasn't talking with him. I was tweeting. We don't talk. We just tweet nowadays. He is one of the Orioles beat writers for The Sun, and he was saying this has been a particularly good year for national anthem singers at Camden Yards. So this, in a way, indirectly a compliment to you. So
awesome.
Thank you for being here. But let's start, go back to the story and cover some of the history here, Mark Farris. It's nice to have you with us again. So I guess we ought to talk about Francis Scott Key a little bit and what got him, I just touched on it briefly there, what got him on a British vessel in Baltimore Harbor, September 1814.
The Key story is definitely fascinating. You think about him going out to free a prisoner, Dr. Beans, who was taken prisoner after the British burned Washington.
So it wasn't hostages. It was one prisoner?
It was one prisoner, Dr. Beans. A bunch of British soldiers ran amok in Upper Marlboro, and a bunch of town folk imprisoned them, and one escaped and told the British muckety-mucks, and then they came and arrested Dr. Beans. They were going to bring him to Halifax, and if he was found guilty, they would have hanged him. And so you have Francis Scott Key and John Skinner getting on a boat in Baltimore, and think about this for a second. We're on a little ship, and we're going to go, and we're going to find the British fleet, the most powerful navy, and we're going to wave a white flag, and they're going to invite us aboard, and then we're going to have, you know, wine and a banquet, and Francis Scott Key successfully negotiated the release of Dr. Beans, but they wouldn't let them go because they were privy to the battle plans for Baltimore. So he wrote the song Behind Enemy Lines. And that is a great story, but my book tells the rest of the story, everything from 1814 up to today. And you will never listen to or look at the song the same way again.
The subtitle is The Unlikely Story of America's National Anthem. So why is it unlikely?
You know, as I first conceived the concept, I knew that it was historic. I knew that the 200th anniversary was coming. But I had never heard anyone praise the song. People said, I can't sing it. I can't remember the words. Oh, it's warlike. They used to complain that it was anti-British. And because it was based on a song that lauded drinking and debauchery, carnal debauchery in the beginning, the To Anacreon in Heaven song. During Prohibition, a lot of the uptight schoolmarmish types didn't like that either.
So to clear something up for folks, Francis Scott Key wrote what's sort of like a poem, right? He intended it as a song?
Yes.
He did intend it as a song.
Yes, that's one of the big misconceptions that have been passed down through the years. Francis Scott Key was very self-effacing, and an actor, Ferdinand Durang, he kind of gave Ferdinand Durang the opportunity to come in and say, well, I performed the first version live on stage, and I put the words together with the song, which is a preposterous conceit, because this melody is so difficult. And Francis Scott Key, as Matt and I were speaking about, as Paul and I were speaking about, he had written a song, poem, to the melody in 1805.
And that song you mentioned, Acreon?
No, To Anacreon in Heaven is the British melody that was the club song for the Crown and Anchor Tavern, the Anacreontic Society.
That was a drinking society.
Correct.
Okay.
Well,
it was a drinking song.
It's a song that does celebrate drinking and carnal pleasures and music. The line is, I'll instruct you like me to entwine the myrtle of Venus with Bacchus's vine.
Ooh, I like it. Okay, so let me just clear something up, Mark Farris.
Yes.
So Francis Scott Key's words were meant to go with that song?
Indeed. When he came and he landed, he told Roger B. Taney, his brother-in-law and law partner, hey, I wrote a song. Goodbye, see you later. I've been held incommunicado for 11 days. I got to go see my family. So it was absolutely his intent to do that. But through the years, the myth surrounded this idea that somebody thought it was a good idea to pair the melody with the words. America the Beautiful is the same thing. That was written as a poem, but that was paired with hundreds of other melodies.
Well, getting back to my question about your subtitle then, unlikely meaning it's a difficult song, it's associated with carnal pleasures and drinking. It's if you want this to be a national anthem, I'm sorry, it's just not patriotic enough, or what?
Well, some people said because it was an English melody that it wasn't a true American song. It is a little ironic that we borrowed the melody of our future national anthem from the folks we were fighting against. Now, if it were not for Francis Scott Key, our national anthem probably would have been Hail Columbia, which is a very stilted song that was, again, a pairing. They used to call them parodies. So it was called The President's March, and it was written in 1789 for George Washington. And then an actor wanted Joseph Hopkinson to marry lyrics to the song in 1798, which he did. And that would have been the national anthem because two Americans wrote it, and neck and neck, banner, Hail Columbia, all through the 1800s, and the banner prevailed. I think.
And how did the banner prevail? We get to President Wilson, right, in the early 20th century.
I would argue that the banner became the de facto anthem almost immediately upon its writing. It spread.
Huh.
I'm not going to use the term like wildfire, but I just did. It spread through Baltimore rapidly. The Baltimoreans took it to heart. And if they had not, you know, we'd be stuck with Hail Columbia or maybe Yankee Doodle. But it spread throughout the country and people took to it. The big five.
So by the time we get to the era I'm talking about, when Woodrow Wilson was president, when action was actually taken on behalf of making that song the national anthem, it was spread throughout. People knew the song.
Well, the military had a big role. The Navy had designated it as an official song. Actually, the Navy designated in 1889 Hail Columbia and the Star-Spangled Banner, one for the flag raisings, one for flag lowerings. But they realized, gee, that's a little confusing. Let's just make it, in 1893, the Star-Spangled Banner. And then the Army adopted it in 1895, and it became pretty much the de facto national anthem. A lot of people were confused. They thought My Country, 'Tis of Thee was the national anthem because that was popular in schools. So you have people writing into the War Department. They write into the presidents. What's the national anthem? I've heard it was this. Should we stand for My Country, 'Tis of Thee? My Country, 'Tis of Thee, of course, fatally flawed because it borrows the melody of God Save the King or Queen,
the Queen, right? Mm-hmm.
Whoever the gender of, whatever the gender of the monarch in power at the time. And America the Beautiful definitely was number two in the 1900s. Until God Bless America came along.
Well, that's funny you mentioned that because in school, in the grade school, I remember seeing America the Beautiful and singing My Country, 'Tis of Thee. I don't remember singing the national anthem. In fact, Victoria, since you're here, you're the one who's actually sang this song in the stadium. You know, that was my experience. So we didn't sing it in school. You went to an event like a game or something or the beginning of an assembly, and maybe you heard it. So
yeah, that's a good point. I don't remember ever singing that.
Okay, so what got you to? So I want to ask you this. I've been dying to ask you this. And Mark, we'll come back to you. And Mark, you want to talk about the music as well and the singing and performance of the national anthem over the years. Again, Mark Ferris, author of Star Spangled Banner, The Unlikely Story of America's National Anthem. So you're a soprano and you're a grad student at Peabody today. And so when did you become engaged with the national anthem in terms of performing it? Did you do it because it provided you an opportunity to sing in public when you were young? I'm just curious.
Yeah, I mean, I guess the thing about the national anthem is that that's what you hear at sporting events. And I, as a child, went to sporting events all the time with my family. So it was something I heard and something that I always heard there. But like you said, never in school. It wasn't something that we stood up and sang as the morning bell was about to go off. But yeah, I guess it was the opportunity to sing in public. As a young singer, we're always thriving and looking for places for people to hear our voices because we're not established. And for something like that, it's just a quick song, something, a melody that you've always known. You could probably find 100 different places to perform that. And sporting events happen to be the most popular because it happens first, and then you can go and get your cotton candy or whatever and just watch the rest of the game. But then you've performed.
So when was the first time you had an assignment to sing the national anthem?
I think the first time was in, I lived in Colorado, and I lived there. I got my undergrad there at the University of Northern Colorado, and there was a wooden bat team. And my mom was close to one of the
women. Did you say a wooden?
Yes, a wooden bat. It's not minor league, but kind of professional team called the Fort Collins Foxes.
Okay.
And they just last minute.
You mean a wooden bat as opposed to an aluminum bat?
They were known as a wooden bat team.
Really? Okay.
No idea.
All right. So did they ask you to sing?
Yeah, just last minute said, are you available next week? And I said, sure, I know the song. And it was much more difficult than I anticipated.
Paul Matthews, I want to ask you about the difficulty here. Is that, I mean, we all assume, I guess because we know it now, right?
Correct.
But is it to somebody who had never heard it before, someone from a different country, English as a second language, I don't know, somebody who had no experience with it, you put that sheet music in front of them and say, okay, we're going to do this now. And they can read music. They're right. A music student. They would find that very difficult?
They would find it not unlike an Italian aria. I mean, that was the fashion in London at that time. It was the biggest concern was the Haymarket Theatre, where they had a royal patent for Italian opera. So, you know, we're told that King George III, in his madness, would wander around the castle and warble out Handel arias.
Mm-hmm.
So I think the song sort of resembles the operas that were popular in London at that time.
Do you agree, Victoria? You're the soprano.
Yeah, it's extremely difficult. You have to go into it as a singer thinking about your phrasing and your breathing, and you have to approach it very smart or you're not going to make it to the end. And
yeah, okay.
Like an aria.
Listen, Robert Merrill, famous opera singer, baritone, he's now deceased, but he grew up in Brooklyn and he's famous for singing at Yankee games. And I got to just tell you a little story here, because we're going to listen to different renditions of the national anthem during this hour of the show. The first one we're going to hear is Robert Merrill. So I just want to tell you a funny story about him. Robert Goulet, who was a contemporary but a popular singer of Robert Merrill, he had a little problem singing the national anthem, remembering the words, famously stumbled over the words before a Muhammad Ali Sonny Liston fight. It was a nationally televised event. Robert Goulet, of course, is actually Canadian, so maybe he should have been forgiven, but people were pretty hard on him for stumbling over the words. And then Robert Merrill, who was used to singing at Yankee Stadium, he said, I'm nervous when I'm out in center field singing, then I'm more nervous when I'm out in center field singing than when I'm at center stage at the Met. The words aren't that difficult. It's the fear of forgetting them. Robert Goulet created a monster. So here's Robert Merrill. He does a very nice version of this, but you will hear him stumble here.
Anthem from Yankee Stadium.
By the dawn's early light, what so proudly we hail at the twilight lap blue stars, whose broad stars and bright stars through the perilous fight, o'er the ramparts we watched were so gallantly streaming, and the rockets red glare, the bombs bursting in air, gave proof through the night that our flag was still there. Oh, say does that star-spangled banner yet wave o'er the land of the free and the hope of the brave.
This is Robert Merrill at Yankee Stadium. Mark Ferris, you're a native New Yorker, huh? You must appreciate that.
I'm amazed that his accent came through so much in that version. His recorded version was used at many stadiums.
I just got to tell you a funny story. I couldn't find it, but I remember years ago hearing him, when he gets to bombs bursting in air, it was bombs boisting in air. I swear to God, Robert Merrill, bombs boisting in air, because he's from Brooklyn, right? And he also, I remember an interview with him where he said he could do it in under a minute, that his goal was to do it in 59 seconds. And this one timed out at a minute 10. So that's the longer version of Robert Merrill. We're going to take a break here. We're going to talk some more about the national anthem when we get back with Paul Matthews and Victoria McGrath from the Peabody Conservatory and Mark Ferris, a historian whose book is Star Spangled Banner, The Unlikely Story of America's National Anthem, is published by Johns Hopkins University Press. So if you have a question give us a ring. Also, if you want to tell us about a great version of the national anthem, or just some comment about the national anthem, perhaps you've performed it yourself, 410-662-8780. Let's have a little bit of fun here. 866-661-9309 is our toll-free long-distance number, and the midday email address, midday@wypr.org.
Can you see by the dawn?
Now that, I hate to almost interrupt it, this is Marvin Gaye. We've received a couple of tweets this morning from folks who said, my favorite is Marvin Gaye, this rhythm and blues version of the Star Spangled Banner. This is the 1983 All-Star Game. So anyway, that's Marvin Gaye. That's listed as one of the best versions ever. Jennifer Hudson also. I've seen a couple of top 10 lists for. My favorite, we're going to hear a little bit later on, it's the Whitney Houston version from the 1991 Super Bowl. And I'm curious, do any of you have a particular memory about a national anthem singer or group that sang it that you remember being particularly impressed with over the years? Any of you?
I wouldn't say a performance, but I like Igor Stravinsky's arrangement for mixed choir, which is hardly
ever done. Stravinsky's arrangement for a choir.
Correct. He did that as part of his training to become a permanent resident of the United States. It was his tribute.
What else did you want to say about this song, Paul? Just looking at it musically, the dynamics of the national anthem?
Well, many of the key intervals in the song are based on, let's say, the Westminster chimes, the major notes in the triad. That are easy to sort of pick out and that you would hear in a chime. Also, the leaps, the high leap, is not unlike the angel's cry that we hear in opera, a sixth. You know.
Mm-hmm.
So there's.
You mean
that
when
well.
We get to the rocket's red glare?
Exactly.
And I better not do it.
Actually,
Victoria, that's why we have you here.
More along What's So Proudly. I mean, that's a huge leap right at the beginning of the song.
Right, right. Victoria, what do you think of the song and the performance of it?
I think that this song is very intimidating. I have always been very intimidated by it, especially because of the leaps that you're speaking of. When you, as a trained singer, are about to sing a high note, you have to approach it, even when you're starting at the bottom of your register, as if you have enough breath and support to get there. So if you haven't prepared yourself well, it will strain. It will be difficult. And that, as a singer, I always want to put my best foot forward, and it's terrifying.
Now, at Camden Yards, you've performed it twice at Camden Yards?
Yes, two times.
And so a couple of things there. Based on what you just said, maybe the tempo is important for you, for your breath, for your breathing, correct?
Oh, absolutely. And they're very particular. They have these performer guidelines. They send you 2 pages of everything you need to know before you come, saying you can't go over 1.5 minutes. Please don't change the original melody. So I often now, as a big baseball fanatic, when I go to a game, I'm listening for the other singers. Are they going to change this year? Are they going to add their own flair? Because does that really do it justice? Does that really do our national anthem what it's supposed to be?
So most of them do a pretty conventional version.
Yeah, that's what is expected.
Okay. Now, the other thing you have to deal with at Camden Yards is the O. Oh, say, can you see?
Yeah.
This has been around since the 70s. A tradition at Orioles home games, and I guess at the Ravens games, is mm-hmm. The whole crowd joins in with you. And you know that's coming, right?
Yeah, they let you know that it's coming. They do warn you, but as a child, that's where I went. So I knew it was coming. It was so exciting. I had this big smile on my face. And you just kind of have to keep going, because if you let that get in your head, you're going to get distracted.
Here's Victoria McGrath, a voice student, a graduate student at Peabody Conservatory at Camden Yards, dealing with that mighty O.
The last
Must be a great feeling when you finally finish that.
Yeah,
right?
I was done.
So, boy. And is the fear of forgetting the words, that must be with you.
Definitely. I've actually forgotten the words one time singing it, so you never know.
Mark Ferris, you know, some people don't like that O that's punched in there by Baltimore fans. It's something controversial, actually. Some Washingtonians who used to come up to see games before they had their own team in Washington were appalled that Baltimore fans did that. Even some Baltimoreans think it's disrespectful or anything. But this isn't the only town where that happens, right?
This is true. I, too, was very surprised. I was in the upper decks at Camden Yards watching a game, and I heard it, and I said, this is Baltimore. I would have expected a little more decorum toward the song.
Because Key wrote it here.
But, you know, I'm not a total purist. People want to have fun with the song. It's not as if it's at a military funeral.
Right.
So why not have a little fun with it? And the other teams that do this, of course, the Atlanta Braves, home of the Braves. The Kansas City Chiefs sing Home of the Chiefs instead of Braves. The Houston Rockets scream out Rockets. The Dallas Stars scream out Stars.
They scream out Broad Stripes and Dallas Stars.
Do they?
Yeah.
Okay.
Right.
Very nice.
I might have a problem with it.
Chicago, well, you might have a problem with in Chicago, Blackhawks fans try to scream so loud during the song that they try to drown the singer out. It goes back to 1985 tradition, quote
really?
Unquote. It's a little odd.
We're going to listen to Marian Anderson here. This is from 1957, so this goes back a ways. Marian Anderson, the first African-American singer to perform at the White House and the Metropolitan Opera. She sung the national anthem at President Eisenhower's inauguration.
Oh, say can you see by the dawn's early light what so proudly we hailed at the twilight's last gleaming, whose broad stripes and bright stars through the perilous the ramparts we watched were so gallantly streaming, and the rockets replay of a bursting in air. It brought to the night that our flag was still there. Oh,
we listened to the whole thing there. I don't want to interrupt it. Victoria, her pace, her tempo is impressive, isn't it?
It's very impressive. Very impressive.
Yeah,
she took hold of that song and just nailed it.
Paul, what did you think?
You know, I think even she messed up the words. I think she said perilous flight instead of fight.
Yeah. It can happen to anybody. As I was listening there, I was wondering, do I like this song? If I didn't know this as our national anthem, if it wasn't so familiar to me, would I think that was a catchy tune that I enjoyed? And I guess I can't tell anymore because it's so familiar. You know, Mark?
I think it's an edgy melody. I love the song. I mean, it's challenging, but I love the song. I think some of the other songs are challenging, too. America the Beautiful has some leaps. God Bless America, that's a tough passage that just keeps rising. One thing that struck me about Marian Anderson, and I think this is an operatic tradition from way back, the rolling of the R's and the through the night. John McCormick, the Irish tenor, had a big hit in 1917 with it, and he rolled his R's. And if you listen to it, you'd say that's a standard version, but the rolling of the R's is a little bit of a personal predilection.
Right.
And one of the things that struck me when she was reaching for the high note, that must have been in a very high key. It was written in B flat C, which is a wind instrument key. And for a long time, a lot of singers said, well, we have to sing it in B flat or C, which is not true. You can sing it in any key and just transpose it. I do it in G, which is very comfortable for me.
Hmm. I was curious about how that's done, Paul, because we had Robert Merrill, who's a baritone, singing, and we just heard Victoria, a soprano, and Marian Anderson. So it's transcribed? Is that it?
I think it's done by the singer turning around to the bandmaster and say, I do it in G.
As simple as that, huh?
Yeah, based on what my low note is and what my high note is.
We'd love to hear from our listeners today if you want to reflect on the national anthem, the singing of it, the performance of it. If you remember a particular performance that you want to share with us, 410-662-8780. The toll-free long-distance number is 866-661-9309. Paul Matthews is with us, who is Associate Dean at the Peabody Conservatory here in Baltimore. He's taught music theory since 1998. He's been a member of the faculty there. And Victoria McGrath, who is an opera singer and graduate student at the Peabody. And Mark Ferris is with us. Mark Ferris just has a book out about the Star-Spangled Banner because of the 200th anniversary of the Battle of Baltimore, which is being commemorated this weekend, the writing of the Star-Spangled Banner by Francis Scott Key. His book, Star-Spangled Banner, The Unlikely Story of America's National Anthem, it's published by Johns Hopkins University Press. I just wanted to ask you all this. When you listen to the national anthem, say you're at Camden Yards, I'm curious how Paul, the professor from Peabody, and Victoria, a singer, and Mark, now just sort of an aficionado and independent historian, what do you do when it's being, do you sing along? Do you listen? What are you listening for? So, Paul, let me try you on that one.
Well, this goes back to what you said earlier in the broadcast. You don't really sing along with it. It's usually presented to you. You know, it's usually something you're supposed to listen to reverentially. But when I'm hearing it, what I typically deal with is that both my wife and my children are looking at me and saying, how's it going? Is it good?
The critic.
What about you, Victoria, when you hear someone else perform it?
I always like to look at the performer and see if they're actually enjoying it, because this is such a scary song. And if you look at someone, you can really tell if they're terrified or if they're comfortable. And I'm listening to their comfortability or whatever the word you would say is, and with the entire song and how they feel with the high notes and the low notes. But I don't want to judge them. They're out there performing. They got chosen to perform, but I can't help it. That's right. As a trained singer.
Right, right. Thank you. And Mark, what about you?
The song always moves me. I stand and I listen and I nod my head because I love the song. I really am a banner booster. But I do just want to raise another great version at a sporting event. After the Boston Marathon bombing, Rene Rancourt sang the song, and he started it off, and he dropped the mic, and the rest of the audience joined in. And they were lustily singing along, which to me belies this idea that it's that hard to sing or that people don't want to sing it.
When moved and asked to, because he stopped singing, as you say. That was at a Bruins game, before a Bruins game after
the
Boston Marathon.
Yeah. Chilling version.
Really, really was. I want you to listen to one more here. This is Joan Jett. Joan Jett, actually, I can't say born in Maryland. She was born in the Philadelphia area, I think, but grew up in Maryland, went to high school in Wheaton. You know, real rock star, a real feminist, a great crusader, Joan Jett. She's just terrific. And I'm pretty sure I heard her sing the national anthem at Camden Yards at one point. But here's an a cappella version. Listen to Joan Jett.
Oh, say can you see by the dawn's early light what so proudly we hailed at the twilight's last gleaming, whose broad stripes and bright stars through the perilous fight, o'er the ramparts we watched, were so gallantly streaming. And the rocket's red, star-spangled banner yet wave o'er the land.
Play ball. Way to go, Joan. And I like her little tribute to Baltimore on her punch on the O. Let's take a couple of calls here before our next break. Carol Ann in Ellicott City calling us on midday. Welcome to the show, Carol Ann.
Thank you very much. I just wanted to say my favorite version was at the Bicentennial Celebration at Memorial Stadium, and it was a man with a guitar, and before he sang, he said it was a popular drinking song during the early 1800s in all the bars and taverns, and here's how they would have sung it. And then he proceeded to play on his guitar and sing it. It was not slow and majestic, but it was marvelous. You could just hear everybody joining in with this very, very fun, happy celebration of our nation.
Oh, I like that. I would love to hear that. Mark?
I have an acoustic guitar and vocal version. I call it Countrified. And it's an original arrangement.
It's similar to what she's talking about.
Yes, and I will be doing it at my signings. My signings will also be singings. But the best and my favorite acoustic guitar version of the song is Jose Feliciano, one of the most controversial versions ever at the 1968 World Series. A phenomenal version where he took liberties with the melody and it was performed live, and it was very controversial. Here we go. This happened before Hendrix's version. This is about a year before Hendrix.
This is 68.
Yes, it is. And absolutely a firestorm of controversy. The American Legion denounced him, and some people call for, I don't know if you know this, but there's no official version of the words or the melody. So they called for an official version to stop any sacrilegious versions like this.
Here's from Mark's book. Jose Feliciano told the media, "A man can express a love for his country any way he feels. The song had practically passed into oblivion. Now it's back in every home as it should be. I don't think kids dig it, so I changed it to suit the new generation." We're going to take another break here. Mark Ferris with us, his book, Star Spangled Banner, The Unlikely Story of America's National Anthem. Mark is in town. I didn't know you were going to sing and sign books. That's cool. So we'll tell folks where they can meet you tonight and again this weekend. Victoria McGrath is with us from the Peabody Conservatory, as is Paul Matthews, Associate Dean. We'll take a short break. We'll come right back. This is 12-year-old Miranda Sung at Camden Yards a couple years ago. 12 years old.
Wow.
Pretty good. And so I saw her this summer. I think only last week she was back at 14 singing it. And way to go, girl. Anyway, Dan Roderick's here. It's midday. We're celebrating the national anthem today because this weekend in Baltimore commemorates the Battle of Baltimore. This is the end of the bicentennial commemorations of the War of 1812. Francis Scott Key on September 14th, 1814, penned the words that became our national anthem. Mark Ferris has written a book about the unlikely story of America's national anthem. It's a book called Star Spangled Banner, published by Johns Hopkins University Press. And we're also talking about the musical dynamics and the performance of the song with Victoria McGrath, a voice student at the Peabody Conservatory, and her dean is here, Associate Dean Paul Matthews from the Peabody Conservatory. Comment on Twitter. You'll appreciate this, Victoria. Kristen says, "I judge an anthem singer by his or her ability or inability to pronounce perilous. If that's wrong, I don't want to be right." Perilous. Where does it come? Perilous, right?
Yeah, yeah. We've heard a lot of different versions of that today.
Yeah, yeah. Paul, what is the advice, and I'll ask you this, about remembering words? I mean, this is English. This is our language. And then there's Italian and German and even Russian in opera, right, that your students at Peabody learn?
Sure, absolutely. I just think it's a mental block. I mean, if somebody asked you right now, what is your phone number, you'd have to think, because it's not something you deal with a lot. This is language we don't use on a regular basis. And it's not so unfamiliar like Italian and German where you have to think it through.
Right.
And so I think people underestimate the challenges of it.
Yeah. How often do you say perilous?
Correct.
In the course of a day, right? Let's take some calls here. August in Towson. August, welcome to the
Hello?
Show. Yeah, go right ahead, August.
Ah, yes. I wanted to comment on the singing of the national anthem at Camden Yards.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted to say that that's probably like my favorite thing about going to the baseball game. I'm also a student in history at Towson and study specifically that era. And I don't find it at all disrespectful that everybody comes together, you know, has that one big powerful, oh, you know, in the middle of the song. I think it's just kind of a really beautiful collective consciousness moment.
Yeah, I tend to agree with that. I don't find what's offensive about it. Some people, like I say, some people find it disrespectful, but thank you very much for saying that. And that was reflected in a tweet we received here from Jennifer, who says, I love the yelling of the oh. It's a salute between or among Baltimoreans, with a little smile added. Let's see. Let me read another tweet. Brian says, my favorite Star Spangled Banner cover is by the great Jimi Hendrix. It's before my time, but it rocks all the time. Courtney says, she likes the Joan Jett version too. She loves the Jimi Hendrix version at Woodstock. Or maybe it was Monterey. No, I think it was Woodstock. Do you know, Mark, Jimi Hendrix?
Jimi Hendrix had played the song for about a year in his live performances before Woodstock. And a lot of people, the Woodstock is the famous one. And if it had not been included on the soundtrack or in the film, people might not have known about it because he died shortly thereafter. A lot of people don't know that he did a studio version that is very different from his live version.
Really? You know what I looked up today? I was wondering about performances of the national anthem in Baltimore. And we had the All-Star Game here in 1993. And James Earl Jones was recruited for the national anthem. Yes, you're gonna say,
I'm going to like this. It'll be interesting.
I listened to this again today. I had completely forgotten about it. They asked him to do basically recitative, to recite it, while Nathan Carter and the Morgan State Choir sang with him, or provided the. You'll have to explain this, Paul. Why don't we listen to it? I thought this was very unusual. I listened to it carefully. Let's let our listeners listen in on it.
Oh, say, can you see by the dawn's early light what so proudly we hail at the twilight's last gleaming, whose broad stripes and bright stars through the perilous fight, o'er the ramparts we watched, were so gallantly streaming, and the rockets' red glare, the bombs bursting in air, gave proof through the night that our flag was still there.
You know what I wonder as I was listening to this? I wondered, how did he resist singing? Do you know what I'm saying?
Right.
Especially when you get to say, can you see, right?
Right. So there's a tradition of melodrama. Copland famously wrote Lincoln Portrait. So where the orchestra plays, mm-hmm. and somebody recites a poem, and James Earl Jones had done that before, so I think that's what he was thinking.
Right, right. And there's, of course, the great Morgan State Choir backing him up. So I thought he was shouting it, though, a little bit too much, like as if he didn't realize he was on a microphone or something. Huh?
A little bombastic, maybe.
Has kind of a Darth Vader vibe.
Yeah. let's go to another caller. Joel. Joel in Essex, thanks for calling Midday.
Hi, greetings. This is one of my most fun topics. I had the most empathy for Annie, the woman who sang and went out of key. She actually went into a different key, and I felt so bad for her. I think that's possibly even worse than forgetting the words. And one other point that I wanted to ask your experts, if you have a limited range, should you start the song as low as you possibly can to make it to the high note? And I'll take my answer off the air.
Victoria?
Yeah, absolutely. But also remember that the first note you start on, you still go a little bit lower than that. So you have to
be... Oh, say, good, good, yes. Good. We'll start, go ahead, go ahead.
Oh, say.
You make so that even, sound easy.
Even just the first three notes that you're singing, the first note you start on, it can't be your lowest note or you're kind of in trouble.
Mark?
What's interesting is that the old sheet music, you do not have that descent. You do not have that three-note descent. It just starts, oh, say, can you see? But through folk usage, it just became adapted and adopted.
Paul has a sheet music here. He's nodding in agreement, Paul.
That's absolutely true. The original song from England had just the first note.
Oh, because they were drinking.
Exactly.
Right? They couldn't handle the rest of it. They didn't want to make it too complicated. Jothin, I'm sorry, Jothin. Thank you for calling, Jothin.
It's Gail.
What's your name?
Gail.
Gail?
Gail, Jothin.
Oh, go right ahead, please.
And, I'm disappointed when we go to sports events that nobody sings the national anthem. You go to the Oriole game and there's 30, 40,000 people there and everybody silently listens to the soloist. And I can't believe that out of all those people sitting there that at least 1,000 of them aren't capable of singing the national anthem. And I love to sing it. I'm not a soloist, but my range is enough, and so is my husband. And you go to high school games where there's no soloist and there's no words sung at all.
Yeah.
We should be encouraged.
Yeah, it's interesting. Because you were saying before, Paul, we sort of stand there reverentially and listen, right? But I've been on occasion, I know I've been with people who sang the national anthem, sang along, but maybe so much effort is put into finding the really good performers that by the Orioles or whoever it is, that you don't want to interrupt them. You don't want to cover that.
It's part of our performance culture. Unfortunately, it used to be a much more participatory event to go to patriotic events and sing along. Sometimes people are waiting for the person to perhaps mess up, so that they can, make fun of them. Christina Aguilera, her version was truly amazing at the Super Bowl.
Is that one of your favorites?
It was one of my favorites because I don't know how in God's name she got back on track.
Mark Ferris, Star Spangled Banner, The Unlikely Story of America's National Anthem. Mark will be tonight at the Barnes & Noble at the Inner Harbor from 6 to 8 p.m. So if you go down to see the Tall Ships, you can also stop in and see Mark at Barnes & Noble. And then on Saturday at the Ivy Bookshop up on Falls Road, again in the evening, September 13th at 6 p.m. So you can stop at the Ivy, see Paul. You're going to sing and sign books.
I am indeed.
All right. Thank you very much. Paul Matthews, thank you for being here from Peabody Conservatory.
My pleasure.
And have another great school year there. And same to you, Victoria. Thank you for being here. I want to end with my favorite version of this. I think it's the favorite version of a lot of people. It's Whitney Houston at the 1991 Super Bowl. So I hope you enjoy this, folks.